the evidence and or the thinking that the animals have an annual cycle in condition where they are in better condition at the end of the summer than they are when they come in the spring, et cetera. You know, being, with terrestrial animals, we obviously tend to think of them struggling through the winter and then the summers when they put on much of their weight. Sam's data suggests that they're actually in their best condition at the beginning of the summer. Is there much consensus among the people who run for the whales as to the annual cycle of condition?
Me?
I think Lance touched on some of this after Sam's talk. I think there's some behavioral observations that are certainly consistent with the animals being in better condition at the end of our summer season, if you like, compared to the start. You know, one of those is the extent to which the animals spend time socializing and don't seem to be working very hard at the end of the season in September. I mean, an anecdote on that, you know, the reason why we picked September for photogrammetry work is we knew that historically there'd be whales socializing in big groups and not spread out feeding, so we could maximize the number of whales we could get over the top of in a helicopter. And that, you know, that's inference and advice Ken gave, and it turned out to be quite right. And it's not the same in every year. You know, we're in September right now, and they struggle to get any two whales next to each other. You know, they're working hard and spread out. Presumably, it's not a good feeding year for them. But I mean, it certainly seems, you know, those of us, you know, trying to get close to whales in the wintertime, they're spread out, they're difficult to approach, they seem all business, they've got a little socializing going on. And that's not necessarily the case as the summer progresses on average. Also, the other evidence for this is not behavioral, it's in mortalities. You know, I know there's a lot of uncertainty about what's causing mortality, but you know, the vast majority of the known mortalities are not in the summer. So if we make a leap of faith that some of these are linked to body condition and nutritional status, then we would expect a few more deaths in the summertime if that was a lean time for them. I'm going to pass on to Lance.
Yeah, another bit of inferential evidence that provides a bit of insight perhaps on this is that timing of births is in the winter. Typically, not always, they can give birth at any time of year, but that would mean that their females are at the peak, or at least their period of their energy expenditure in lactation would be some months after birth, presumably. And if physiologists, you can jump up and wring my neck, but and so that would bring them back into females providing maximum amount of milk in the summer.
And I think we also see behavioral changes that we tend to see in years of low food availability. For example, group sizes get smaller, crowd speeds get higher, day ranges get larger, and the social communication sounds become a lot less frequent, so you get a much higher proportion of echolocation, which we think is associated with the search for prey. So, it doesn't tell us what their condition is, but it tells us they're working a lot harder to make a living that kind of year.
First, I want to clarify something. I know I said they came in their best body condition, their best condition. But really what I'm saying is they're coming in suggesting that they have had their most energetic feeding. So that doesn't mean that they didn't, because that's really what the physiology is reflecting. So they could have had really bad condition in the winter, come out in the spring with this really good high nutrient surge of fatty fish, that causing their P3 levels to go extremely high. So it doesn't mean they're overall condition was better. It means that they came in after feeding on a very, very rich fat source that was sustaining them until the Fraser River.
Yeah,
anything else from the panel?
Well, maybe I should just put Dylan on the spot with a question about. Maybe I should just put Dylan on the spot. All of you have studied individual whales. What's the route of insight about the population? Sort of step by step inferential process that we go through to arrive at conclusions based on studies of individuals, to arrive at conclusions about how these populations work. That's really what we're going to ask about.
That it kind of depends on your sample size. If you are doing, if you're sampling a large number of individuals over time and having it representative over time, then you can make assumptions about what the population is. If your sampling is much more spotty, then you have much, the individual variability contributed by a single individual can be greater than the whole picture. So I think it really depends on your, the number of samples you're getting. So, you know, from my standpoint, I look at though as though I'm taking a cross-section of the population over time. And a good analogy is that if you look at radio collaring data on terrestrial mammals versus the kind of sample that we're doing very like in the tar sands where I described, with radio collaring, you're getting a huge amount of information on location from a single animal. But you may have 10 animals that you have got information from. So if you're trying to convert that to what's going on at the level of the population, one individual would greatly skew the overall view. Versus taking sampling very cross-sectionally for dogs where you're getting, you know, 1,000 samples over those same that same population, you're getting very few samples per individual, but you're getting a very good cross-section of what the whole population is doing. That, I think, is much better able at projecting the population trends. And we've shown that with our data by taking our resource selection models that we get from stat versus telemetry. And if you take the resource selection models that you get from stat in your own area and we go and compare it to radio collar caribou 100 kilometers away using radio collar data, it fits beautifully. But if you try to go the other way, it doesn't work. You get maybe 60% fit. So the point is that if you're trying to project what's going on in the population by seeing what's going on at the individual level, and that's what everything is doing. And when one animal dies, there's one animal that died, one individual that died, but you're trying to put it to what the overall population is doing. And, you know, that's just a matter of getting a lot of detail for individuals, showing inter-individual consistency, which gives you the population trend.
So maybe I ask my question poorly, and I'll follow up with the example you gave of radio telemetry studies, which I do quite a lot of, and usually what I'm most interested in is survival. And it's very easy for me to say, here's the framework I'm going to use to make inferences about what this population is going to do by measurements of survival. It's a sufficient parameter. It allows me to say things that are quite clear about so if we're not measuring survival on the group, but if we're, say, measuring hormone levels, what's the path to insight about how the population will behave? So maybe I've made an undue distinction about individuals. I should have perhaps focused more on what we're measuring. In the case of measuring survival as a group, but the path to insight is very clear. When we measure other things, prey requirements, body mass, hormone levels. What's the route? What's the inferential route to how the population behaves?
But it's not clear that what you're describing, because you have an event, fish abundance, and then you have what the population response was a year later. or however long your interval is. And so many things happen in between. So, and each of your N is year. And so if you're trying to get something that looks at what are the individuals doing between point A and point B to see, does that allow you to get from what you're seeing as your environmental impact and your demographic response and consistency, then you have essentially connected the dots. So I think, you know, even with telemetry data, if you don't have very many animals with collars on them because your GPS collars are expensive, then you can get a very skewed impression of what's going on at the population level.
I think that one word of the question, I think a little different than what I was thinking of the first time, but I think that these data can help determine what the mechanisms might be. So you see changes in population, you see changes in abundance, but if you have other data, like the physiological data, energy consumption data, the body morph metrics, and you can say, oh yeah, that makes sense because we're seeing something that we'd expect, and then that actually seals the deal even more, and you can provide some sort of mechanism.
I would just like to add that before you get enough samples per individual, that you should at least be looking per pod, and that this lumping these data, I think, are occluding incident because of the geographic distribution and exposures that we know they have. So as much as we can, to look at the group's differences before you get down to the individual differences. Once you get enough data, obviously you want to know each individual.
Sort of simple-minded view here, but in terms of population, if it were all males and they had 99% survival, you know, eventually you're going to have nuts. If you have females that are not bringing off viable offspring, I think that would be the major. Some of the non-success would be due to just episodes of grave situations. Some of them be due to the individuals, like sort of bad joke, but we have some females there that every calf they have died, and you know, so we're going to name the next calf of that female. So it's not going anywhere. Whole major lines, they're not going anywhere. We could do all kinds of statistics stuff, but as a rancher of such things, you would look at whether or not you have any reproductive capability less than the population. I think you have a lot of information, and it does require.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think one way to start with it is where the routes aren't coming from. I think they're going to come from sort of optimal foraging considerations. They've got to have, you know, killer whales like everything else have to have enough to eat. But I think the insights are really going to come from studies of behavior and social structure. If we go right back to the beginning where this workshop started, they really they came from an emerging understanding and appreciation of the fact that these critters are selecting a particular prey type preferentially. And we can discuss how strong that selection is, and it's critical. But that it exists, and I don't think there's any real doubt about that. And it certainly exists on a level of resident and transient killer whales that are eating fish versus marine mammals. That's a hard thing to put into sort of optimal foraging kind of framework. It doesn't seem to make any sense. Presumably it does if Darwin is rolling over in his grave. But this propensity of killer whales to specialize is presumably something that will make sense of at some time, but it's very strong. And another aspect of behavior I think that's critical is that these animals carry around a memory of areas that they foraged in previously and their success in those areas. And that affects their success in profoundly, I think. I personally think this is probably why it's so difficult to correlate. It's a very clear signal of overall Chinook abundance and the fates and fortunes of both populations of resident killer whales. When you look at individual stocks, it's harder. It's sort of counterintuitive. You think you start with the big fuzzy picture and you find out the important stocks and get tighter, it gets weaker. And presumably that's because they're very good at sampling the environment when they run out of fish in one area. Remember, John, we used to see this in Johnson Strait all the time. They have killer whales come in the early summer, check it out, and then leave again. If there weren't lots of Chinook, they'd leave. And if one of our colleagues happened to be up in the river's inlet, often they'd show up 12 or 15 hours later and they'd check that out. And if there weren't fish there, they'd make some judgment about how many fish there are, and they'd leave and they'd check out another place. So I think they're very efficient at finding fish up there and finding places where they, not necessarily just fish, but places where they can, where they're abundant enough and distributed in a way that they can catch them. But they don't, at the same time, they don't switch prey easily. And even in captivity, they don't switch prey easily. If you raise your killer whales in an aquarium on a particular prey type and you try to switch them, it can be very difficult. And sometimes you have to convince them behaviorally to switch by rewarding them in order to persuade them that they can actually stop eating herring and start eating salmon. So that sort of counterintuitive aspect of this prey selection. It's presumed that behavioral environment is profoundly important.
I just want to say, I think the question is a great one, and it's really a great one because we've not really thought about it. You know, everyone's up in an about this. And, yeah, the last 7 or 8 years, we've seen this boom in research funding to study southern residents from nothing to a lot. And because of that, there's been incredible tool development. We've learned a huge amount in a short amount of time, but there hasn't been enough reflection to think about what the inferential framework should be. So I think if anything comes out of these discussions, that's what it should be. You know, funding shouldn't necessarily be allocated for individuals' pet projects, but actually, let's have a think about what is the inferential framework and how do these things fit together and how can we coordinate more effectively under a framework. You're completely right, there isn't a framework. We have a great ability to monitor individuals and in a very complementary fashion and coordinated fashion. It's undoable.
Yeah, a lot of this discussion, Tom's original point, was how do we go from individual variation to performance to population performance. One of the things that I think is missing from this workshop is a comparison of population performance across a wider range of populations. We're looking at southern residents, and a lot of times when we say, is this normal, you look at northern residents, and they might not be normal either. And I know there's several, many populations throughout the Northwest into Alaska. So I'm wondering how much is known about those populations, and is it something that's worth pursuing to putting together a meta-analysis of some, how common is it for one female to never have a calf survive over the what? Maybe that's just happens.
That's a really good point. Someone earlier, John Durbin mentioned that it might be instructive to look more carefully at trends we see in the population of some of the Alaskan residents. workshop, you know, their population growth rate in some cases exceeds the northern residents, so it's the same preferable to incorporate as many populations as we can, at least for the resident type animal, the ecotype that is focused on salmon. They have different behavior patterns, they're very essentially like different species than are, for example, the transients, which are some patterns. Unfortunately for the transient ecotype, as well as the offshores, which are probably fish feeders, their social structure is so dynamic that we don't have nearly as precise annual census data as we do for the residents. So we're a long way distance from ever, I think, having the level of detail that we would need to make useful comparisons.
I wasn't going to talk about transients as much as residents as we extend further west and north into the far north Pacific. And we just wrapped up 10 years of studying kill whales and the Aleutians and Barents Sea. And, where there's an incredibly high abundance of resident kill whales. Just around the central and eastern Aleutian Islands, there's 2,000 to 3,000 resident kill whales. You know, here we're talking about 80 to 90. In this population, so it's in a population. It makes you realize just how peripheral southern residents are in the range of resident killer whales and how extreme their status and dynamics may be. You know, I hear that anecdote today about the age at which the males are reaching physical maturity. We'll compare that to, so southern residents are age reaching at 17 to 18 years old. Gulf Alaska residents are reaching this 12 to 13 years old. Well, Aleutian Island residents are reaching 9 to 10 years old. They're growing really, really quick. So although our longest-term studies come from southern and northern residents, as we move into these northern waters where there are a lot more residents that are probably doing a lot better, we realize that the dynamics of southern residents are not normal. And I totally agree, northern residents are not a normal standard. There is a lot of information out there on residents, particularly in the Gulf of Alaska, where parallel studies have been going on where we have known life history is much in the same way as we have in northern. So if you go further west, we have much more of a sampling approach, micro capture sampling, micro transit sampling, not including the enumeration, but there's a huge amount of data rather than being drawn into a meta analysis.
Yeah. I have a question for Joe. Is there also information on diet for those resident
populations? There's a lot of information on diet being collected in the Gulf of Alaska by Craig Mack and his crew. Through scale sampling in the same way, showing preference for salmon, perhaps a bit more coho salmon in the summer diet, but certainly spring preferences for Chinook. As we go further west, diet is a big unknown. These are the whales that depredate longlines very heavily. They eat that for mackerel, they'll eat halibut, but we don't know much about their diet. There's not a lot of salmon there in the summertime. As you go west of Kodiak Island, it seems you can get away from salmon specialization. And again, Lance is pointing out, resident killer whales extend even further west into Russian waters, and the Russians know a fair bit more about diet. I mean, it appears that acromacro are a big part of their diet. As it appears in the central Aleutian Islands, residents, in fact, John's made a point in the past that you could probably break residents apart into those that specialize on salmon and those that don't. They're very different. The ones that are in those areas where they're feeding on acromacro are hugely abundant and have a very different demographics and actually very different morphometrics. So we're measuring these in photogrammetry. The different beasts are hugely abundant.
Well, I think it's beer time. And the bar's open. So we can have more conversations that way, probably, rather than one-on-one. So hopefully it all will. So thanks very much.